There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanell, and I'm your host. On today's program, the country's biggest radio pirates merge. But it's not who you think. It's Sirius and XM Satellite Radio. John Anderson from DIYmedia.net joins to discuss this interesting wrinkle in media consolidation. You do want to stay tuned. Welcome again, John. I'm glad to have you on. First, I have to know, do you have iPhone fever? 3G iPhone fever?
No, actually.
You know, this is a technology show in many ways, and, you know, we get a little geeky here. And, you know, the 3G iPhone came and went and is out there, and we haven't even mentioned it on the damn show.
No, actually, I hate to tell you this, man, you being the media geek, but I'm only on my second cell phone ever. I bought my first one in 2004 because I didn't have any other phone at the time and needed to have a connection. And I just bought my second cell phone in January or February, I think it was. And all I wanted it for was to be able to text and to be able to make phone calls. And so I searched online and I went to all the gadget websites and I looked at all the reviews and the consumer reviews and everything. And I found an LG model. And they basically said the camera on it sucks, the video camera sucks, it doesn't have a lot of storage for your MP3s, but if you want a phone just to make phone calls and text messages, this is the phone for you. And so that's what I got. So I'm totally not with the whole internet surfing on my phone thing and all that. I just, no. A phone is a phone for me still. I'm too old school.
Yeah, I guess we shouldn't be giving Apple any more free advertising here. I've got a 3-year-old Motorola that continues to sort of get through life as it is. And no, I have not yet caught the iPhone fever. But I figured, you know, it's sort of obligatory for a technology show here.
Yeah, no.
I mean, you know, maybe I should, you know, one of us should have been online and calling in live and talking about all the Uber geeks waiting, you know.
Standing
and how
in
long,
line, right.
And how long it takes to get it activated. I know the morning of the big iPhone release, I was riding my bike to work in Evanston, just north of Chicago, and I definitely saw people lined up outside the AT&T store in downtown Evanston, and that's as close as I got to
Now the 3G iPhone is still an exclusive phone to AT&T, right?
They're yeah, it's still exclusive. You have to sign a 2-year contract with AT&T, and currently there still aren't enough to get or go around even. So people have these online trackers to see which stores have phones or how long the wait is right now. So, you know, it's still a big privilege to have them take $200 of your money and take away two years of your free agency.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think there's some related technology viruses out there right now inhibiting U.S. consumers. One of them is the iPhone and the second one is the Wii.
Yeah.
I think those two go hand in hand, because I know there's been a run on a Wii, and I know that, of course, you have a Wii.
I have to admit to having one, yes.
Yes, yes, you were able to score a Wii in Chicagoland, and I still haven't caught that fever yet either, which is good, because otherwise I'd never get out of it.
But I'd have to sign any contracts, and in fact, a lot of people had to buy these packages where you get like 6 games you don't care about and 19 different controllers, so that the whole, you know, so the Wii, you know, otherwise costs like $250, but you have to buy the $500 package. That's how they've been gouging you. And I actually bought it without it, all the garbage. Somehow I managed to just buy the Wii all by itself.
Yes.
And didn't pay extra. Didn't pay any exorbitant rates and to do the eBay $400 thing. And I wasn't even trying very hard.
Just keep practicing that spin on bowling. You'll have
exactly.
a 300 score before you know it.
That's what I'm working on. Well, so let's get to real spin. How's that
okay.
for a segue? Let's get out there to real spin, because why we're talking it today is because the FCC finally, after months and months of anticipation, has approved the merger of XM and Sirius Satellite Radio. And this is a merger that you and I have talked about quite a bit. I've covered on the show now ever since it became even an inkling that it might happen. And we've actually talked about XM and Sirius for reasons having nothing to do with their merger, because of the fact that they are the biggest pirates, the biggest radio pirates in the country.
Yeah, it is unbelievable that the entire XM and Sirius merger decision did not come down to all of the things that our tea leaf reader friends thought it would. A lot of people said, oh, this is going to be a split vote. It'll be bipartisan approval, and there will be public interest obligations tied to the new Sirius XM, as it's going to be known. And what happened, in fact, was over the course of 5 days, starting on July 21st and ending on July 25th, the Federal Communications Commission deliberated non-transparently amongst themselves and cast votes individually to approve the XM and Sirius satellite merger. And the way it went down was this. Monday, on the 21st, Chairman Kevin Martin set the tone by initially voting in favor of the merger. So he's the first vote that was cast, and he said aye. Robert McDowell, another Republican, who is not very big on broadcasting per se, he actually has a background in lobbying for the telecommunications industry, immediately followed in Kevin Martin's footsteps and voted aye pretty much, I think, on the same day. Tuesday, the 22nd, Michael Copps voted no against the merger because he did not believe that the FCC should necessarily revise the rules of the satellite radio industry. As you know, when satellite radio was first created and was deliberated as a service that was going to be unrolled in the 1990s, the FCC mandated that there be two competitors in the satellite radio marketplace. So by allowing the two competitors to merge into one, the FCC basically has to go back and change the fundamental rules of the entire service. And that was something Michael Copps wasn't willing to do, so he voted no. So by Wednesday, July 23rd, two commissioners had voted yes and one had voted no. The fourth commissioner to vote was the other Democrat, Jonathan Adelstein. And Jonathan Adelstein was holding out because he wanted significant public interest obligations put on the new satellite radio company. And one of those obligations was going to be the provisioning or reservation of a certain number of channels for non-commercial, educational, and what is called qualified entities programming. That's, I guess, code word for minority-owned satellite radio programming services. And basically, Martin et al. Was not willing to put as many public interest obligations on this decision as Adelstein wanted. So by Wednesday, he had voted no, and there was a deadlock, 2-2, two Republicans, two Democrats, and the entire vote came down to Deborah Taylor Tate, who I don't really know what her qualifications are for being on the FCC. She came from the Tennessee Public Utilities Commission, so it's not like she's got a lot of advice on this. And there was actually some press earlier on during the deliberation process how she was really relying on industry to make her decision. And she held out on approving this merger. And it wasn't based on anything that, you know, the pundit said it was going to be based on, how many channels for non-commercial, how many for this or that. It was based on resolving a two-year long investigation that the FCC's Enforcement Bureau had opened up on XM and Sirius. And there's two major components to this investigation, and they both involve radio piracy. The first component was the fact that XM and Sirius were essentially running a network of terrestrial repeater stations. Now, just for some background, You think when you're listening to satellite radio, you're listening to a signal from space, but that's not actually the case. The space-based radio signal can only cover less than half or about half of the entire United States. It doesn't work very well in urban areas. It also doesn't work very well in very rural areas. So what Axum and Sirius discovered was that they needed to put a network of terrestrial repeater stations that would take the space-based signal and basically rebroadcast it on the ground. So if you're listening to satellite radio, chances are more likely than not the signal you're getting is actually coming from an antenna bolted on a tower, on a cell phone tower somewhere.
Right, especially if you're in an urban area where there's a lot of tall buildings or other structures or mountains or something that might impede your view of the southern sky.
Right. So Axum and Sirius had both set up networks of hundreds of these terrestrial repeater stations around the country. In XM's case, there were several hundred. I don't know how many Sirius had set up, but it's a pretty large number. And it was discovered that XM and Sirius were both running repeaters illegally, in the sense that they did not tell the FCC where they were. They told the FCC they were running at a certain power level, but they were actually running at another power level. And in some cases, they didn't even inform the FCC of certain repeaters' even existence, which meant they were essentially running unlicensed terrestrial repeater stations. And the scope of this is important to keep in mind. Just on the case of XM, the number of repeaters that were illegally operating, either without licenses or out of tolerance or out of parameters, served 42% of the nationwide footprint of the radio service. So if it weren't for XM especially running these pirate repeaters, they wouldn't have been able to provide the service that they were running. And Sirius was doing the same thing, and the FCC found out about it, and they started an investigation. So that's one side of the transmission air chain. And on the other side of the transmission air chain, there are these aftermarket receivers you can buy for your car, that if you want satellite radio and you don't buy a new car with it pre-installed, you buy this little thing called a transceiver. And effectively what it does is it takes the satellite radio signal and converts it into an FM signal. And it's broadcast on a frequency that you can actually select inside the unit. And then in your car, you tune to the frequency that your transceivers inside your car. You can tune to the frequency that the transceiver is tuned to and listen to your satellite programming through your regular stereo, okay? And there is a certain power level that these transceivers have to be capped at. It's a very common power level. It's called Part 15, and it applies to all unlicensed FM transmitter use. Well, it turns out that XM and Sirius had worked with these aftermarket transceiver manufacturers to design, construct, and market transceivers that were more powerful than the FCC's rules allowed. And so suddenly in major markets like Boston, a soccer mom is driving down the highway in rush hour, and she's listening to the local NPR station. And she pulls up next to another car that has one of these transceivers in it, and they're listening to Howard Stern. And the transceiver happens to be tuned to the same frequency as the local NPR station. Now, in normal circumstances, this wouldn't really matter because the interference between the two would be so low. But if you're suddenly stuck in traffic and this little mobile FM transmitter pulls up next to you, it can blanket your receiver. And the next thing you know, where you were listening to Morning Edition, suddenly you've got Howard Stern and a porn star on the air talking about orgasms, you know, and your 6-year-old kid is in the car going, "Mommy, you know, what's
going on?"
Right.
And that's because many of these transmitters used by XM and Sirius tend to have the concentration of the selectable frequencies on the left end of the dial,
right,
where exactly these NPR and also Christian stations tend to be concentrated.
So it was hurting non-commercial radio, and complaints started coming in, and it actually made, like, the Boston Globe wrote a story on the fact that in the Boston area, people were complaining that these commuters were interfering with their own reception of terrestrial broadcast radio stations.
And that's something we actually talked about quite a bit here on Media Geek.
Yeah, and I mean, so if you think about it, not only was XM and Sirius running hundreds, I mean, we're talking at least 200, probably closer to 300, maybe even more, of these transceivers illegally, or these terrestrial repeaters illegally on the transmission side of their air chain, they had also sanctioned the creation of a fleet of mobile FM pirate radio stations that were essentially relaying their signal to not only the subscribers that bought the transceivers to listen to the programming, but also the public at large that happened to be near them. And that is an amazing amount of pirate radio activity that two companies knowingly engaged in. And here is where this scandal ties into the merger. Deborah Taylor Tate, the final commissioner to vote on the approval of this, did not cast her vote based on public interest obligations or anything like that. She cast her vote on whether or not they could settle this scandal. And on Friday afternoon, July 25th, XM, Sirius, and the FCC's Enforcement Bureau entered into a consent decree. A consent decree is basically a way of admitting that you've done something wrong without it actually being on your record. So corporations often get consent decrees from the FCC for doing something bad. But the consent decree says you don't admit wrongdoing, but you make a voluntary payment to the U.S. Treasury and you won't do it again. It's like a slap on the wrist. Well, XM and Sirius's consent decree is pretty large. It says that both companies combined will pay $19.7 million as a voluntary contribution to the U.S. Treasury, and they will enter into a compliance program with the FCC to make sure that they don't market overpowered transceivers and they don't run terrestrial repeaters out of variance or without a license. And XM and Sirius, as part of this consent decree, were told they had to either turn off or modify the operation of 111 existing repeaters. And that is the crux of the entire scandal for me. The FCC knew for 2 years that XM and Sirius had been engaged in the widest, most egregious act of broadcast piracy in U.S. history. And the FCC allowed XM and Sirius to continue breaking the rules while they were under investigation until the very last minute, i.e. when that consent decree was signed. And then once it was signed, Deborah Taylor Tate cast her vote yes Friday night. And that is how the merger came down. It came down not because of we want to add more flavor or diversity to the new merged entity. It was the new merged entity is culpable of pirate radio on a grand scale, and we have to clear their names before we can legitimately approve this deal. And that's how the deal was done.
Sounds like I hear or feel the presence of the broadcast lobby in the background there. They, you know, virulently opposed this merger from the very beginning and continued to. And I know another thing that they got as part of the approval was that XM and Sirius promised not to air local programming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, furthermore, I mean, they've been barred from doing so up to now, but they sort of, you know, double promise, you know, with their hand on a Bible now to air no local programming. And I wonder if it was also the broadcast lobby whispering in the ear of Deborah Taylor Tate, you know, about this situation with the both the repeaters and the transceivers, because it's something which they made quite a bit of noise about when it was first discovered.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, this investigation's been going on since 2006. And in July of 2007, the National Association of Broadcasters actually filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FCC to try to unearth some of the dirty laundry and the details of the ongoing investigation into this massive amount of piracy. So the NAB has been on, you know, the FCC's hindquarters about this for quite some time. And it was obvious that the NAB was pushing the FCC to resolve this. I don't know exactly how much they were involved in the actual negotiations over the consent decree. I know that the NAB was more interested in things like, you know, as you said, trying to make sure that XM and Sirius would not engage in local broadcasting. And they were also trying to push for part of this rulemaking to make all new satellite radio receivers interoperable with HD radio, the digital version of terrestrial radio. And the FCC did not decide to do that. And they're actually going to take that notion up in a separate inquiry, which has come out of this merger rulemaking. So how satellite radio and digital terrestrial radio will compete for the dashboard still kind of remains to be seen.
What's interesting about all of this, one, is that it took so long and then, you know, still happened behind closed doors. And for all of the delay, they still were not able to get either of the Democrats on board, especially when Jonathan Adelstein seemed far more willing to go with it, provided that they made a few more concessions towards the public interest, which they still were unable to pull out. And it seemed like Kevin Martin was stuck between two you know, warring sides there. Either he was going to swing with Deborah Taylor Tate and, you know, really take action on these illegal transmitters, or swing towards the Democrats and ask for more channels specifically, and for more public interest concessions. And I'm not surprised that he swung towards his own party, especially since he might have been more willing to swing towards the public interest mandates if it seemed like cops would come on board and he might be able to get a larger victory than 3-2. He would probably prefer to have a 4-1. But cops is never going to come on board, it looks like.
No, I mean, and let's look at really the marketplace, you know, the market conditions of the satellite radio industry. Here we have two companies that have never turned a profit, that are still raising venture capital in certain areas in order to stay in business. And it was clear that under the current regime, the two companies themselves were so far away from making a profit that the actual, you know, existence of satellite radio service as a viable means of mass communication was a little bit, you know, on the tenuous side. And so the FCC and especially people like, you know, Jonathan Adelstein recognized that, you know, that the marketplace was not working as they thought. And so maybe the lesser of two evils is to have a merged entity, but there have to be certain restrictions on that entity. And I mean, some of the early things that were coming up were, well, if XM and Sirius are merging, then they should cede half of their spectrum. You know, if the two companies are becoming one, then why do they need twice the spectrum? Then maybe we can. And I mean, his idea was, let's take, say, all of Sirius's spectral footprint and turn it over to a not-for-profit organization to run. And so we would have Sirius XM, the commercial version, and then we would have some other organization entity that would be running a non-commercial version. And that's what he was holding out for. That's the kind of public interest obligation he wanted. And he was very upfront about saying, yeah, you know, I am predisposed to vote for this merger, provided that the public interest obligations are strong and substantial enough to mean something. And what Kevin Martin was willing to do was less than what Jonathan Adelstein wanted to do. And like I said, they all voted individually over the course of a week. So by, you know, Wednesday, the vote is 2-1 for the merger. And it's Adelstein and Tate who are left, you know, hanging. Who's going to cast the deciding vote? And Adelstein stuck with his guns and said, you know, the kinds of reservations for non-commercial programming that you are making available are not good enough. Therefore, I'm going to vote no. And that put everything in Tate's lap. And I really do think that I think that in certain ways, what really made this decision go down the way it did was not necessarily any external forces. I think it was the FCC's Enforcement Bureau. I think that the FCC's Enforcement Bureau said, yo, wait a minute. We're sitting on a huge bomb, and we need to defuse this bomb, because if we approve this merger while still investigating these companies for this massive, willful, repeated, egregious violation of Section 301 of the Communications Act and, you know, violation of Part 15, we're just going to look terrible, you know. And the broadcast trade industry press and the mainstream press have not picked up on this angle of the story, and it was going to come out eventually, and it did come out. you know, when the press broke Friday saying the merger was done, it mentioned that there was this consent decree for these technical issues. But of course, many mainstream journalists and many, you know, broadcast industry journalists are not technically savvy enough or have not looked closely enough into the proceedings history to realize that this was a really big scandal that had to be cleared before the merger could even move forward. So they did it, and they cleared the decks, and now supposedly there will be this compliance program. We have no idea how many of these illegal transceivers are actually still in the marketplace. It could be tens or hundreds of thousands, if not more. We do know that XM and Sirius still were running, as of, you know, a week ago, 111 illegal terrestrial repeaters, which they have now apparently turned off or tuned down. And they've entered into a so-called compliance program to make sure they don't do this again. But again, the fiscal realities of the satellite radio marketplace are what spurred XM and Sirius to break the law on both ends at the same time. And those fiscal realities, the need to turn a profit, the need to be sustainable, are not immediately wonderfully solved magically by a merger.
No.
And so my fear is that this kind of behavior where we tweak the rules or don't pay attention to them or whatever will now be officially quasi-sanctioned by the FCC, and we won't hear anything about it ever again. And that remains to be seen. And there's another important element, infrastructural element to keep in mind here when we talk about satellite radio. And that is that even if 4% of all channels are opened up to non-commercial educational use, it's not like the FCC just created a new radio service where people can go out and apply for licenses and set up their own transmitters. It's not like people are going to get a channel on Sirius XM and then be able to set up their own ground station to beam their programming up to the satellites. All of the programming, whether it originates with Sirius XM or not, will be fed through Sirius XM's transmission infrastructure.
Right.
Which means that, in effect, Sirius XM has ultimate gatekeeper control over access to those channels. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if, while the FCC was making the decision on who was qualified and who was not in order to have these, you know, 24 open channels, they were doing this decision under the counsel and advice of XM Sirius or Sirius XM, you know, as a way to see, well, how will this round out the existing channel menu, you know? Sirius and XM already have political talk radio channels, you know, Sirius
right.
Left and Sirius Right, right, you know, and things like that. So should we have those types of services offered in a non-commercial way if we already have a commercial version of it? You know, it's much like the broadcasters in the 1930s, you know. You can either reserve spectrum for non-commercial broadcasters, or we can work through the existing commercial broadcast networks in order to provide non-commercial programming. And that's kind of what we're doing here with satellite radio, is that commercial infrastructure owners are going to be forced to open up part of their infrastructure to non-commercial educational and qualified applicants, programmers. But who those people are and how they will be chosen probably will have a little bit of Sirius and XM's fingers on it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we will keep our finger on that pulse as we see whether or not the public interest really is served, or whether, once again, it's just mere lip service to get over another hurdle, a fairly long multi-month hurdle, but nevertheless a hurdle. John, thanks for keeping us up to date and for also digging into the issue underneath the issue that wasn't getting play. And was certainly underreported there. And, of course, your website's at DIYmedia.net.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's always a pleasure.
And that brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I will be back in 1 week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the Media Geek website at MediaGeek.net. It's home to the Media Geek blog. And if you're doing the Twitter thing, you can go ahead and follow my tweets at twitter.com/MediaGeek. And of course, you get the radio show at radio.MediaGeek.net. And the program is heard on FM airwaves all around North America on great stations like WRFA, in Jamestown, New York, and CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And the Media Geek Radio Show got its start on the FM airwaves at WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Still airing the program Fridays at 5:30 p.m. And if you're interested in getting Media Geek onto your non-commercial radio station, well, all you need to do is drop me a line, paul@mediageek.net. That's also the email address you use for all other correspondence related to the show. That's paul@mediageek.net. Thanks for tuning in.